Some verse read for the Key West Library. Most of it early and young by an old man.
This is Poetry Off the Shelf from the Poetry Foundation, July 3rd, 2013. I'm Curtis Fox. This week, the poetry of a one-night stand. Tennessee Williams is arguably America's greatest playwright. Some of his best plays, like The Glass Menagerie and A Streetcar Named Desire, were huge hits when they came out, and instant classics that are regularly performed today. Williams was also a terrific short story writer and essayist, and he wrote a couple of novels. Less known is his poetry. There isn't much of it, two volumes, but as you'll hear in a moment, his poems are pure Tennessee Williams, earthy, sensual, mordant, and a little decadent. Arlo Haskell is a poet and the associate director of the Key West Literary Seminar, and he joins me now from Key West. Welcome back to the program, Arlo.
Thanks, Curtis. It's great to be on the show again.
Tennessee Williams recorded some of his poems in 1971 at the Key West branch of the Monroe County Public Library in the studios of WKWF. Tell us a little bit about the recording and how it was recently rediscovered.
Yeah, well, this was a reel-to-reel recording that was discovered in the vault at the Key West Library on Fleming Street in Key West. I first heard of it a couple of months ago when one of the librarians there approached me and said, hey, we have an audio recording of Tennessee Williams. You know, we'd love to get it digitized and share it with you. So I was pretty excited about that. And I thought it might be a poem or two. You know, it's 30 minutes of Tennessee reading a selection of his poems. It's fantastic stuff.
Can you tell us a little bit about Tennessee Williams in Key West? How long did he live there and what drew him there in the first place?
Yeah, Tennessee started coming to Key West, I think, in the early 1940s, and then Key West was really a constant presence in his life until his death in 1983. He had first traveled to Key West, I believe, when he was living in New Orleans, and just fell in love with the place, as many people do, as many writers do. Eventually, he bought a house here on Duncan Street. I think that was in the later 50s, and you know, kept that house until the time of his death. One of his letters includes the great line, "I work everywhere, but I work best in Key West." You know, it was never his full-time home, but it was a home among other homes, and it has a large role in his creative development throughout his life.
So it was there's a literary scene there, very small but important literary scene in Key West, and you guys are the inheritors of that scene. But was there also a gay scene that Tennessee Williams was drawn to?
There definitely was a gay scene, both public and private. I mean, among the visitors to Tennessee Williams at his home in Key West were Gore Vidal, Christopher Isherwood, the playwright, was living in Key West at the same time, James Leo Herlihy, the novelist. So this was a group of gay writers, novelists, you know, poets, playwrights, etc., that collectively found a very kind of fertile, creative place in Key West.
So we're going to listen to two poems. There's one poem on the recording that was never collected. Would you tell us about The Wayward Flesh?
It's a poem of love lost and love scorned and love not quite being given up on, I guess. It's a very, you know, powerful and kind of goosebump-giving love poem.
Now, it seems like a poem written by a very young man. It's conventional in sound, if not in sentiment, too. Do you know when in his life he wrote this poem?
Yes, it is certainly an early poem and a poem that doesn't feel like the work of a mature poet, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, I was listening to one of your earlier shows with Sarah Rule recently, the playwright, who said that bad poets make good playwrights, yeah. Or maybe bad poetry makes good plays. And I thought that was an interesting observation, thinking about Tennessee Williams and his poetry. His true gift was as a playwright, but I think he saw himself as a poet. I think he identified as a poet, and I think he wanted to be a poet. And I think, you know, that's shown on this recording that he's, you know, he's reading these early poems that were already 20 and 30 years old, but he still felt very strongly about them and still really identified with what they had to say. You know, I think his core self was a poet self, I guess.
Well, let's give this one a listen. Here's Tennessee Williams in 1971, an old man, as he said at the top of the program, reading a poem probably from his youth.
The wayward flesh has made me wise in many things I should not know. Perhaps if hawks tore out my eyes, your image would not plague me so. Perhaps if these red veins should freeze in glacial snow an age or two, and then be dipped in Arctic seas, I should be rid of wanting you. But if I could indeed by such harsh measures exercise your charm, so that no sight nor even touch of you had power to disarm my rarefied and stately ghost, I fear I should find being pure and coldly unensorcelled most too comfortable a sinecure. And finally, if chance there'd be to follow where the flesh once fell, would forfeit all felicity to share your bed of coals in hell.
So Arlo, this is a man, this is a poet, so enamored with his beloved that he'd gladly burn in hell if he could share a bed with him or her there. There's no explicit pronouns here. We don't know if it's a man or a woman, but one assumes, it being Tennessee Williams, that it's a man.
Exactly. Yeah, I had forgotten about that part of the poem, that not only does he want to share the bed with this person, but he wishes that this person would be in hell. I mean, it's this complicated thing where he loves him and he hates him and he can't be without him, obviously.
And it's curious that the way into experience, the wayward flesh, it begins, has made me wise in many things I should not know. There's a sense of original sin here. He's irresistibly drawn to sensuality, but there's a sense of its damning qualities as well.
Yeah, it has an original sin quality, and more broadly, maybe just like a biblical quality or this Shakespearean quality, this kind of primal, elemental sense of things. That's certainly what attracts me to the poem, early and immature or not. I think there's a real power in there that says something about Williams's art.
Let's listen to another much better poem, actually. This one is called Life Story. It's also one that we have on our website, poetryfoundation.org. It's more mature in voice and in form, though I looked this one up. It was first published in 1937 when Williams was only 26. Is there anything you want to add to this one before we hear it?
Let's just hear it. This is a great poem, and you know, his is the perfect voice to hear it in, obviously.
Yeah, and it's one of the rare poems in life that doesn't really need an introduction and is totally comprehensible from beginning to end, even the first time you hear it. Here's Tennessee Williams reading Life Story.
Life Story. After you've been to bed together for the first time without the advantage or disadvantage of any prior acquaintance, the other party very often says to you, "Tell me about yourself. I want to know all about you. What's your story?" And you think maybe they really and truly do sincerely want to know your life story. And so you light up a cigarette and begin to tell it to them. And the two of you lying together in completely relaxed positions like a pair of rag dolls a bored child dropped on a bed. You tell them your story, or as much of your story as time or a fair degree of prudence allows, and they say, "Oh, oh, 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 oh," each time a little more faintly, until the "oh" is just an audible breath. Then, of course, there's some interruption. Slow room service comes up with a bowl of melting ice cubes, or one of you rises to pee and gaze at himself with mild astonishment in the bathroom mirror. And then, the first thing you know, before you've had time to pick up where you left off with your enthralling life story, they're telling you their life story exactly as they'd intended to all along, and you're saying, "Oh, oh, 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 oh," each time a little more faintly, the vowel at last becoming no more than an audible sigh, as the elevator halfway down the corridor and a turn to the left draws one last long deep breath of exhaustion and stops breathing forever. Then, well, one of you falls asleep, the other one does likewise with a lighted cigarette in his mouth. And that's how people burn to death in hotel rooms.
That's good. That's, that last line is so unexpected and so funny.
Yeah, it comes out of nowhere, and it you realize that's what it's been building up to all along.
So it's a comic poem, ultimately, but and you can hear his pleasure in the comedy as he reads it. But what do you think it's saying about casual sexual intimacy, if anything?
He seems bored by it, ultimately, I think. You know, he's looking for something deeper and more profound. You know, he's looking for the kind of intimate sexual connection that will make him either ecstatic or tormented. I think he's pulled towards either of those extremes. And I think they're just sort of there for the sex, for the moment of the, you know, the kind of quick bodily pleasure. And maybe here you get that sense of original sin that we were talking about earlier with Williams, too. You've had this kind of physical gratification only to then go down in a hotel fire.
There he is, back in hell.
Yeah.
In the hotel fire. Yeah, so funny. So as I said, this is one of those rare poems that can be comprehended immediately. It reminds me of stuff of his on stage. And a playwright, of course, has to be comprehended immediately as well. Do you see a relationship between this poem and his plays?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I think it is very prosaic in that sense and intelligible on its surface level. I think when I was listening to the full recording, you know, as he gets to this poem, it's striking how different it is from all the rest. You get it right away. You get it. You know, even if the morality of it, of, oh, they've burned in this hotel room, even if that's a little more complex, it's a story that he's telling and you get it more straight on.
Mm-hmm. So you live in Key West, right?
I do, yes.
Uh-huh. So what's the legacy there of Tennessee Williams and his long residence in that town?
Yeah, Williams in Key West is much beloved. I think of his legacy here as being, he's sort of a damaged guardian angel for Key West. He, of course, had lots of troubles with drugs and alcohol late in his life. He battled depression, you know, but throughout he maintained this kind of, you know, beatific, angelic quality about him and his work, I think. And there's, you know, Key West is home to lots of demons that people battle here. He was also... when Gore Vidal was in Key West a few years before he died, he talked about coming to visit Tennessee Williams in Key West. And his nickname, Vidal's nickname for Williams, was the Bird. And I remember Vidal saying that there were no more birds or beautiful songs in Key West ever since Tennessee had died. And it was I didn't quite get it when he said it, but then later on I put it together and he's talking about, you know, Tennessee Williams being gone. So I like to think of Williams as either guardian angel or official bird of Key West, as someone whose voice and whose spirit is still kind of in the air here.
Arlo Haskell, thanks so much.
Thank you, Curtis. Again, it's a great pleasure to be on your show again.
Arlo Haskell is the Associate Director of the Key West Literary Seminar. If you go to their website, kwls.org, you can hear the full recording of Tennessee Williams reading his poems, plus a rich audio archive of many poets and writers who have given their readings at the Key West Literary Seminar. Let us know what you think of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org. The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. For Poetry Off the Shelf, I'm Curtis Fox. Thanks for listening.